One man may seem incompetent, another not make sense, while others look like quite a waste of company expense. They need a brother's leadership, so please don't do them in. Remember, mediocrity is not a mortal sin. There
we're
in
the brotherhood of man, dedicated to giving all we can.
Oh, aren't you proud to be in that fraternity,
the great big brotherhood of men.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, July 24th, 2016. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today, we have Michael Portantiere and Nat Tamanini. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, Everything Sondheim, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You could see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
Also with us is Matt Tamanini. Matt is Broadway World's senior TV and film critic and the host of Some Like It Pop podcast, which is available on iTunes and Stitcher. You can connect with Matt on Twitter at BWWMatt. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, James.
Peter is on the road today, so we will see Peter again in the future, but just to let you know that Matt has stepped in the role of Peter Felicia today, so thank you, Matt.
No, don't make me try to fill his shoes. That's not fair to me. That's really not fair.
I would like you to become an instant encyclopedia on all things Broadway for the last 200 years, please.
Not going to happen. I've got Google, though.
Excellent. I don't think that Google is as smart as PETA is.
Probably not.
So, Michael, on our recommendation, you got a chance to get up to Lincoln Center and see Oslo. So tell us, what did you think about Oslo?
Yes, thank you for the recommendation. I had not arranged to see it, I don't know, for several reasons. I guess I had been traveling a lot lately and it just didn't work out. But, and then you guys, Peter and James, you loved it so much, and the reviews were stellar, and I thought, oh, now I'll never get in. But I tried, and the press people were very nice, and they got me a ticket, and I went, and I just thought it was fantastic, this new play by J.T. Rogers. The Lincoln Center Theater Review, which is available in the lobby always of the Beaumont and the New House, and is always such an informative publication and is available basically free, although they'd love you to give a donation, and I advise you to do so. That Lincoln Center Review has a wonderful little piece by Alexis Gargagliano, which gives us the setup of how this happened. So I just read from that. It says, during the run of Lincoln Center Theater's production of J.T. Rogers' Blood and Gifts in 2011, director Bartlett Sher introduced two Norwegian diplomats, a husband and wife, to the playwright. In the lobby after the show, they told Rogers, we have a tale, and we have been waiting 20 years for the right person to tell it to. Over drinks, they revealed that they had played a major role in secretly organizing the back-channel talks that led to the Oslo Accords, an agreement between Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization that was signed in 1993. Thus, a seed was planted, starting Rogers on a road of reading and research that led to the writing of his next play, Oslo, about one of the most fraught political relationships of our time. At its heart, the play is about people, Israelis, Palestinians, and Norwegians, struggling with their ambitions and passions, working to overcome their fears and mistrust to forge an unheard of peace. So that's the background. And I mean, it's so impressive on so many levels, just the fact that that was the impetus for the play to be written, just this conversation between these people. The fact that presumably beforehand, J.T. Rogers knew little, if anything, about the subject matter, and then did incredible research on it. The fact that this couple, and you know, I have to apologize again, because I do think generally speaking, I'm good at pronunciations, but Norwegian is not one of my languages. Oh, so it's
Michael,
Mona.
If you can't get it, we have no shot then. Hold you up as my example.
Yeah, but I mean, but not this. All right, not Norwegian. Anyway, so it's, I think they pronounce his name Terke. It's T-E-R-J-E, Rod, R-O-D, dash Larson, played by Jefferson Mays, and he's the director of the FAFO Institute for Applied Social Sciences. And his wife, Mona Jewel, I think that's how it's pronounced, Mona, J-U-U-L, played by Jennifer Ely, who is his wife, and she's an official in the foreign ministry. So they are the ones who completely without any official authorization or whatever broker this peace talk between the high-ranking Israelis and Palestinians. And it's really an amazing play. More than one person, including several people seated around me at the show when I saw it, pointed out the similarity to 1776 in the sense that you know how it's going to turn out, but still the suspense is just really riveting. And that's, if that's not a side of great playwriting, I don't know what is. There's a wonderful moment early on where the main Palestinian negotiator, played by Anthony Azizi, it's a very quiet moment. They're just about to meet the Israelis for the first time, and he sort of takes a moment, and I believe Jefferson May says, what, you know, are you okay, what's happening, and the Palestinian says, I have never before met an Israeli. And it just was such a powerful moment that you know, how can you hate people if you don't even know them, for heaven's sake, and how can you ever attempt to even have any kind of peace if you don't discuss. So I thought that was really very, very powerful. And the as James and Peter mentioned, it's a long play. It's three acts with two intermissions, but I honestly can tell you that you do not feel the length because the subject is so important. The discussions are so interesting. I would contrast it with The Coast of Utopia, which I know I'm in the minority apparently, but for whatever reason, I was deadly, deadly bored by that play, those plays. I think it's because I didn't feel, I felt that the discussion in those plays was so much, so theoretical in a way, and more about ideas than realities. But here it's about people and their passions and people trying to get along and trying to work against however many, you know, decades and decades of hatred and crimes against each other in order to forge peace. I just really thought it was wonderful, and I'm so glad for its success, and I do hope that there is some venue for it to have a longer life, whether on or off Broadway.
Well, and that was going to be my question, is I've heard a lot of rumors about it transferring fairly soon, maybe this, you know, early of 2017, maybe even into a theater like the Beaumont or something like that. I mean, do you think that this is a show that at 3 hours being, you know, more or less a history play, you think it would be appropriate for a Broadway run?
Well, you know, I mentioned the Beaumont when Peter and James discussed it last week, and I think they both felt that would not be a great idea. Having seen the play, I understand why they would say that. It is very intimate. But on the other hand, the way it's done at the New House, there is a wall, basically, you know, a set piece of a wall that goes diagonally across the length of the stage upstage. So if one were to do that at the Beaumont and basically just cut off that entire huge section of the Beaumont stage that's behind where the proscenium arch is, and then plate everything below that, I think it actually might work really well. And of course, the advantage of doing it there is that A, the theater's empty, and B, Lincoln Center owns it. So I think financially, I assume that would be much more conducive than trying to do it at the Lyceum or wherever. I think it is good enough, despite its length. And, you know, even if the subject matter is maybe not as attractive to people as Aladdin or Cats, I think that it is so good that I always feel like there's room for one or two plays like that at any one time, even on Broadway. And so I think that that would be a wonderful thing to do. And of course, even if it didn't end up having a long run in the Beaumont, it would still be Tony eligible if it, you know, assuming that it ran long enough to get all those people in, which I'm sure it would. And then they will not have had spent tremendous amounts of money on the transfer because they're just moving it upstage to the Broadway space of the same not-for-profit theater organization. So I hope that happens. And I mean, I have no idea what other plans are in place, if any, for the Beaumont, but we'll see. We'll see.
For listeners who are not familiar with Lincoln Center, it's literally the new house is right physically below the Beaumont. It's,
yes.
It's like moving this production up one story.
and the theaters are almost like it's like almost the same in configuration, but yeah. The Beaumont is much larger, and the Beaumont has I'm not sure if they call it a mezzanine or a balcony. I suppose they call it a mezzanine, and the new house does not. But the fact that the configuration is the same, basically a three-quarter thrust with the audience seated in a semicircle around the stage, would make it easier for a transfer. And there have been transfers in the past, right?
I think this is where we need
Peter's encyclopedic knowledge.
Yeah, I didn't look at what wasn't that. Didn't that musical transfer? Maybe not. I'll have to look.
So I thought about a lot of it last week after you had mentioned it, and the more I thought about it, the more I felt you were right that could make a transfer if there is not another thing going into that space.
Right, and also as I mentioned, if it came to that, they could always close the mezzanine at the Beaumont, which happened before. They did that when that Anne play, that one woman play that Holland Taylor did about Anne Richards. I believe they closed the mezzanine for that. So if they feel they don't want people sitting that far away from the stage for Oslo, they could always do that, and they'd still have, and it would still be Broadway. It would still be considered Tony and Broadway eligible because it's more than 500 seats. At least that's my interpretation.
So many other productions there have been nominated and won Tony Awards. I don't see why not. Absolutely.
And yes, and Anne is a good thing to mention because Anne was, it was one person, wasn't it? And if it wasn't one person, it was very few. So if you could do a one person play there, I mean, many people felt it wasn't that successful, but the point is they did it. So I don't know. The Beaumont, when you do lop off that rear section of the stage, which has sightline issues anyway, it's still fairly intimate despite its size because of the configuration of the way the audience is seated, and the sidelines are great because it's stadium seating, and it's got a lot going for it. Even though it was considered a very problematic theater back in the day, but people seem to have made it work for many, many decades now. And so we'll see.
All right. So that's Michael's take on Oslo. I think that we're all unanimous in that if you can get a ticket to go see it, definitely go see it. It's truly wonderful. And I'm glad you picked up the Lincoln Center Theater Review, the magazine, because it really helped me to understand the backstory tremendously. And it's so beautiful and well done as well, the magazine as well as the production, of course.
Yes, and when you take a copy, please give at least $1.
Yeah.
Because we want to support that.
Okay, So with us, we're going to have somebody special join us. Rob Johnston is joining us. Rob is somebody that I know as met because he was a listener who emailed me, and I've gotten to know him, seeing him at the theater many times. In fact, I think, Rob, there's a very good chance that you actually see more theater than I do, and more theater than 99.9% of the world does. So thanks for joining us. And Rob and I were at Privacy the other day, seeing Daniel Radcliffe down at the Public. And I thought I would bring Rob in to get his take on it because he, you know, as I mentioned, I consider him somewhat of a professional critique now because he sees so much theater. So Rob, tell me what's your thoughts on Privacy?
I really enjoyed it. I was impressed not by the content, but by how terrifying it was to somebody who spends as much time on their mobile device as I am. And I got to tell you, I locked down a couple settings after leaving the theater Thursday night. It's almost less a play than a series of vignettes about how much information every one of us with a smartphone, and beyond that, general media connectivity puts out there in the world, and using Daniel Radcliffe as sort of an everyman with a little bit of, you know, just enough plot that it didn't lose me in the process, as it takes him on a journey from London to New York and discovering more and more about what's going on behind the scenes. And right in front of our faces.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I'm so glad that you used the word vignette, because I could not place that word, but that exactly sums up what those scenes were. And I would try to dance around it without giving away any of the secrets of the show, because it's important to have those secrets not exposed. So flag me if I accidentally stumble into one. But the Daniel Radcliffe, just a wonderful and amazing performance. And they use a lot of techniques in this show to engage the audience into it, which would make Matt Tamanini very uncomfortable.
Yes.
We've talked about Matt.
Leave
Matt,
me out.
Matt and Peter Felicia both do not enjoy audience participation shows. And so one of the things that they asked us to do was when you walk into the theater, there is a card, like an 1117 laminated card in the seat in front, on the back of the seat in front of you, that tells you how to connect to the Privacy Wi-Fi network, because they are going to ask you to do things throughout the show in order to move the show forward. And so they ask everybody, please turn your phones on. Oscar Eustace, the artistic director of the Public Theater, gives a very funny opening recorded speech. That Rob, have you ever heard anything like that before? We got to get
not explicitly saying to leave the phones on, but he takes you through that 11x17 card that is designed to look like the informational card that you'll have for the safety presentation when you board an aircraft.
Yeah,
I did take a photo of that I can send to you.
I took one too, but yeah, send it on to me. Absolutely. So we can share that with our listeners so that they can see this card. Oscar Eustace, very, very funny recorded opening speech. We're going to have to see if we can, you know, it's not unheard of that the artistic director of the Public takes the stage, is it now? So we see if we can get Oscar on stage. And I really enjoyed it. And it's in talking with many people after the fact, you know, I spend every single day of my life in technology, and there's not a lot of stuff here that I didn't know about, but this is presented in a way that is a bit available to express technology things, information in a way with people who are not technologists. And so what they did during the show was connect to our Wi-Fi network, and you can connect it to their Wi-Fi network. And what they did was they scan, after you connected to the network, they scanned the network, and they were able to tell you a lot of things about yourself.
So when you're connecting to that Wi-Fi network in Starbucks or various other free Wi-Fi places that you're not thinking much about, they presented that stuff in the context of the show, so half book, half improvisational. And they pulled people's information off of public information like Twitter and Facebook, and they used your pictures on the projections, which were used really well at the Public Theater, and incorporated the audience's story into the story of privacy and privacy. So they said privacy when they started in London, and they said privacy when they came to New York, again, Daniel Radcliffe gives a great performance. It was really, you know, everybody in the cast takes on multiple roles. So they act as different things. There's a lot of very funny things for those of us who might be addicted to Amazon Prime, such as I am. Lots of Amazon. Rob, did you think that maybe Amazon was a sponsor or a producer of the show with so much Amazon on stage?
They almost would have to be, just otherwise they would have had to spend, you know, double the budget just ordering enough to get that number of boxes. Also with the projections and the fact that you were saying about everyone playing multiple parts, most of the characters being played by the rest of the cast besides Radcliffe, who is just the writer, you always know who they are, because once they're introduced, their name and the photo of the person that they're portraying is displayed on the wall behind them. And then anytime they leave and come back, at least their name comes back. So even though there are dozens of people, and there is in fact a bibliography of all of those characters in the back of the playbill equivalent. Playbill itself. Couldn't remember if it was Playbill or another type program. You always know who they are, and that's even done to comedic effect at one point, as Rachel Dratch has to switch between two characters mid-scene. And I wanted to comment that every actor that you see on stage at any point during the show is just outstanding, in some ways surprising in ways that you wouldn't understand until later in the show, and just a rock solid ensemble from start to finish.
Yeah, we should say that many of the characters that are portrayed on stage are IRL in real life. And they're pulling information that is scientific and studies that have been published and various articles and interviews that are real, and they try to use as much of the real text as possible, so that it's a dramatization of what is really out there. This is not a science fiction leap. This is what is happening to us every day as we are online and living our life through our mobile devices. And then they take a dramatic leap, you know, towards the end, in which I felt sort of this show a little bit came off the rails. That might be a place for improvement if this were to live on in the future. What do you think, Rob?
It was effective. I kind of realized maybe a few seconds before that twist what I thought was going on, or what was going on. But even when it did that hard right turn, I thought it was very well executed. And it might be a little heavy-handed, but I think it was needed to make the point that they were making at that point.
Yeah. And so a couple of times through the show, they asked us to do people in the audience, take out your phones and take a selfie and send it to them at various email address that they projected on the stage. People did that, and they used that. And then they used another picture of, please send us your favorite place in New York. And they used that sort of montage thing as well. But they really used that as in essence, clickbait. You know, they didn't really care about the picture. They wanted to get your email address and your name so that they could do research on you.
They did tell us, and we got your email address when you purchased your ticket. So, you know, we didn't do anything underhanded. You gave it to us when you bought your ticket online. I was actually very thankful that I had won on the Today Ticks lottery and didn't buy it through Ticketmaster or whatever service the public, they use their own site. It's still terrifying.
I'm glad you brought up Today's Ticks because I wanted to talk a little about that. I was sitting fourth or fifth row center in a really great seat. And Rob, you were two rows in front of me in the center. So you like second or third row center. You had won your tickets on Today's Ticks. The folks sitting to my left was a couple that was from... I can't really remember where they were from, but they didn't speak English, and they didn't really understand or get the show, and they talked incessantly throughout the entire show, and they were like, it was like, we're a tourist, and we went on Today's Ticks, and I had a broken conversation with them at intermission, so I found out that they had no idea about this show. They had no interest in seeing it. They just, you know, kind of entered this lottery and they won it and they came to see this show, which is sad because this show is totally sold out and there's a lot of people who are passionate and theater fans who are not getting in to see this show because various folks who don't really care about it who have just, you know, I have something free to do in New York. I'm going to go. I won this thing and I'm going to go see it. And then they sat and they talked throughout the entire show and not whispered, talked in their full voices throughout the whole show. And they thought it was hysterical. And I was like, I was so sad because there's so many people that were like, oh, you're seeing Privacy. I really want to see it. I'm trying to get tickets. I'm entering the lottery every day. It's totally sold out. I can't get in. And so I think that that's a new unintended consequence of like these the digital lotteries. I mean, Rob, you do digital lotteries a lot and you've seen Hamilton how many times?
7 times, but I've not won on the digital lottery. That all goes back to when it was, one time it was. The second time I saw it at the Public, a friend of mine won the Today Ticks lottery and graciously brought me along. I think if he would have realized the luck I would have in the regular lotteries after that, he might ask somebody else. I hadn't really thought of that. I guess the one knock on Today Ticks might be that you can get into doing the lottery portion of it without going through a description of what the show is to give you an idea. And I did want to correct one little thing. It wasn't free, but it was definitely...
Yeah.
A lot cheaper than a regular ticket price would have been.
No, absolutely. I apologize. I did say it was free, and that's not what I meant. I was thinking about various Shakespeare in the Park, which is free, done through the digital lotteries that can be there. So, tell us, we'll leave Privacy behind for a few minutes. Tell us about your experience with the digital lotteries. You see a bunch of shows, don't you?
Yeah, I see as much as I can afford, and because of that, I'm always looking for the cheap seat. I've seen a lot of shows from the back row of the mezz or balcony, just to get in, and when I like something, I am unabashedly a repeat attender, and will return to see shows over and over again. Sometimes I'll just be like, I want to see a show today, what can I get into? And sometimes it'll be Today Ticks. Sometimes it'll be, I subscribe to a bunch of lists of discount codes. I try to keep my actual full price tickets to just a couple a year. Although the last 2 years there have been a number of closings that I'm like, I am going to closing night and pay full price. Digital lotteries, it depends. Depends on the show. I hate the digital lottery for Hamilton, although I understand why it needs to be. I just get concerned that when you're getting 1,000 or more people who will show up and are obviously in New York to do a lottery, you can be assured that they're available to go. The only person I know who's won the digital Hamilton lottery is a friend of mine from Orange County, California, who called me excitedly, say, Rob, I just won the Hamilton lottery. I'm like, oh, I didn't even know you were visiting New York. And he's like, I'm not. I'm at home. I'm like, why would you enter and then take the ticket away from somebody who is, you know, able to get there between when you buy the ticket and showtime? But although I know that Hamilton is doing everything that they can to try to make sure that the people who are getting the tickets are people who are actually going to see the show and not scalpers, not professional resellers or anything like that. So I don't want to knock them that much. But with other shows, you know, it's interesting. And, you know, I got to give credit to Jujamson because on their site, they don't just list their shows that they do a digital lottery, but they actually below that have a link to almost every other Broadway digital lottery going on. It needs to be updated right now. They haven't added the Cats lottery to it, for example, and that's face facts. The lottery is probably the only way I'm going to go out of my way to see Cats. I love the original London cast recording, but I've been underwhelmed anytime I've actually seen it. Again, like I said earlier, I need a certain amount of plot to be able to hook into, or I just get bored and my mind starts wandering, even if the music is great. So it's definitely handy, especially for, you know, people like me who all my expendable income kind of goes into theater in one way or another. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it does help me see everything. I think Cats right now is the only show currently on Broadway that I've not seen. I'd need to double check that, but before the other new shows start popping up, although that's to a certain extent, that's as much thanks to attrition, because I don't get to see all of the limited run plays or things that often are totally sold out, and I certainly would not have been able to see Privacy or Privacy without the lottery. So it's a hugely useful tool to a theater fan who is, you know, not in the industry and not professionally comped or otherwise helped along. So
before before you go, I wanted to mention that before we started recording, I was telling Michael and Matt that I'm an admirer of your Facebook feed, where you have pictures with seemingly a lot of stage door pictures with folks in the Broadway circuit and off Broadway circuit. You have a picture from Privacy the other night with Daniel Radcliffe that you had taken on Thursday night. Do you have any idea how many stage door photos you have with the various stars, and who you have a favorite story about any of them?
I don't. I actually, yesterday I was going through and, you know, I have them saved to my desktop computer, and I was pulling all of the photos off of my phone yesterday, and I pulled at least 100 off then to drop into that folder. Favorites.
You had a Doctor Who one, didn't you?
There's just been a lot of cool ones. Pardon?
You had a Doctor Who one?
Oh yeah, David Tennant when he was doing Richard II at BAM earlier this year. There are a lot, and I do have friends who are like, I occasionally will get comments going, oh, I even know who that is. the Daniel
my
Radcliffe
favorite,
one.
The Daniel Radcliffe one's like, hey, that person looks just like Harry Potter.
Yeah, and I replied, well, .. Wanted to make sure I didn't say anything that kind of slammed her for not recognizing him.
Yeah.
I did say to him, though, I got a laugh at out of him. I said, I got to tell you, this is the most terrifying thing I've seen on a New York stage since Paramore the other week, which he got a chuckle at. That's a whole other story, though. But no, I mean, Florence Henderson, Eve Plum, just to cover some Brady Bunch
Brady's,
cases, Rip Taylor, when Seth Rudetsky interviewed him at his Chatterbox show, bunches and bunches of people, and probably every cast member who's ever been in Rock of Ages. Mm-hmm, yeah, I'm sorry. Right. I'm a fan.
You had seen Rock of Ages how many times?
Closing night on Broadway was 140. And I've seen
Great
seven
Scott.
Performance.
Repeat yeah. attenders. Repeat attenders.
Repeat attenders. But that was more for the different cast members. You know, going and finding out that Justin Sargent was making his Broadway debut. I ran in and did the lottery and got to see that. Final performances, stuff like that. It was my go-to, particularly when it was at the Brooks, to do the lottery. I was seeing a show every Tuesday night, so I would go and lose the hair lottery, run over and win the Rock of Ages lottery. And it just met a bunch of people at the stage door, both fans and cast. And that cast really embraced its fandom in a way that was kind of unique and was kind of awesome. So,
Well, Rob, thank you so much for jumping in on a Sunday morning and telling us about your experience, both with Privacy and your stage door meetings. I appreciate it. And I will see you at the theater.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir.
Okay, moving on. I'm going to swing down south because it's not hot enough here in New York to where Matt saw a production of Equus that was interesting in Orlando. So, Matt, tell us about that.
Yeah, this production itself, and the reason I wanted to talk about it because it's we're recording its final performance is within the next few hours. But I wanted to mention it because this production was staged not by a regular theater; it was done just by a producer who's doing not just immersive and interactive stuff, but doing really intimate shows. This was done in what could very generously be called a small barn. I probably would refer to it more as a large shed on a event space that has a lot of weddings and stuff like that. There was no more than two dozen seats in this entire performance, and we were very tightly packed. So if you can imagine how intimate that would be for production of Equus, not only with people in horse attire and moving around on these big kind of stilt things like horses, but then also when you get into the climactic scene, how much more intimacy and uncomfortableness that can bring. It got me wondering that I've started to see a lot of these things living outside of the New York area. One of my favorite theater companies there is outside of Atlanta, called the Serenbe Playhouse, which is in a co-op community known as Serenbe. But they do all of their performances outside, but they do them in different places, whether it's a production of Oklahoma that they do in front of this big barn, or if it's Hair, they do it out in this huge field, or they do some in the woods. So they're really site-specific things based on the show. And I started to wonder that you two guys see so much theater in New York. I wonder that because there is such important institutions of theater in New York, do you get to see shows like this that are not just site-specific and outside of a theater, because I know you see some of those, but that are super intimate, just you and a couple dozen people. Is this something that you guys get to see in New York very often, or is this something that really is just kind of a construct of people having to think outside the box, where theaters aren't as pervasive as they are in the New York City area?
Well, I'm not sure. It sound like there were more several questions there at once.
Pick one.
Well, I mean, we sometimes see very, very small off Broadway shows. And then I still occasionally will see a community theater show, either on Staten Island or maybe in Brooklyn or in New Jersey. But they're not, none of them are necessarily also site specific.
So, the use of being site specific, did it help change the show? Have you ever seen a different production of Equus?
I have, yeah. This was the second time I've seen it. The first one I saw at Actors Express in Atlanta, which is one of the best theaters in Atlanta as well, but it was done just in a normal theater in the round, and it was, you know, a really interesting production. But, you know, this was in a, like I said, in a large shed in a barn. It had hay bales on the stage that worked as the furniture, a nice big bench as a bed or couch, and you know, farming implements on the walls, and they had these huge barn doors that they came in and out of. So I mean, it was very very much playing to the equine nature of the show, which you know, which I don't know that added a whole lot, but the claustrophobic nature of it, where you've got 25 people or whatever really on top of each other, and the actors were coming in from different doors and they were walking around you, and especially when you had the horses, which were on, you know, not huge stilts, but, you know, a foot tall stilts that clamped down, it really did become a, I don't want to use the word oppressive because it wasn't like I was in fear of anything, but that show is so emotionally fraught that being that close to the actors, where you could not only hear, but at times you could feel the breath of the actors on you because they were that close, it definitely changed the show for me. And I don't know that it was in a good way or a bad way, because as James mentioned earlier, I don't really like being the audience participation type thing. So it definitely probably impacted me and made me more uncomfortable than it probably did other people. And I was actually almost as far away from the stage as you could be, even though I was no more than 10 feet away. But it definitely gave me a different experience. And similar to like when I mentioned Serenby, when they did Oklahoma, Curly rode up on an actual horse, and I was, you know, it was pretty cool. I mean, you could smell the horse coming in. And actually, they're doing Miss Saigon right now in a field where they actually have a Vietnam era helicopter fly in for every performance. Oh. So it's pretty incredible what they do. And I like those things. I think those things are so creative, because we all know that New York is such a theater town that it is, even those small theaters that you mentioned that are off Broadway or off Broadway, in one way or another, they're a destination. They're part of this big community. In places like Atlanta, even though it has a huge and thriving theater community, or here in Central Florida, that has a big arts community, but it's mostly centered around the attractions and the theme parks, you kind of have to do these things that are a little off the beaten path and a little outside the box to gain some of that attention. And so I've really kind of found myself drawn to those things, even if I don't know that they're always executed as well as they could have been, perhaps in a proscenium stage. I'm really drawn to the creativity and the ingenuitive thinking that goes into them. So I always try to look those, you know, try to find those things out. And like the same producer that did this Equus in this little shed or barn, I don't exactly know what all these words mean, but he's doing Dracula this fall in an Edwardian fetish club. I don't know what that means. I know what all the individual words mean separately. I don't know what they mean together, but I'm looking forward to it just because it is something that is outside the box and is really different. And I think it brings something new to a show if you are able to kind of, you know, get it outside of what we normally think is a theater with the aisles and the, you know, the chairs with the cushions and, you know, and all that stuff. It's just something different that I really enjoy that I'm not sure everybody across the country gets to see as much.
Well, you know, I'm just thinking now, we do still have Sleep No More here in Manhattan. Yeah. And then I saw last year, several months ago, which I reported on, The Grand Paradise in Brooklyn by Third Rail Projects, which is an immersive theater experience, a late 1970s tropical resort, a fountain of youth that promises to quench your deepest longing. And we all arrived and, you know, we were supposed to be the guests, and brought us into various cabanas and spoke to us about various things and made us drinks and handed us ropes to play with. And so, I mean, that didn't have a narrative like Equus is, and it does, and it's not a pre-existing show. But we do have things like that. Now, where is that production of Miss Saigon with the actual helicopter?
It is at the Serenby Playhouse, and I'll make sure James has the link. It's outside of Atlanta. I mean, it's a decent drive from where you live in Atlanta to the west, I believe, if I remember correctly. And it's run by the artistic director. His name is Brian Cloudis, and he does really great work. And it's in I don't want to describe the community incorrectly, but from what I understand, it's basically like a co-op community where they've got nice gardens, and they're very eco-friendly. And what they do is, for every different production they do, they find a different part of this, I don't want to use the word society, but this land that would be appropriate for it. And they've got a big field. They got a working Vietnam era helicopter that flies in and out every night. And they've got some great video that they've shot, you know, kind of as some marketing for it. And it's really neat. And I love what they do. The shows I've seen there, I've liked. I haven't necessarily loved, because I think there's a certain artifice that they put on them that I don't always jive with. But I love just the creativity that they bring to everything. And like I said, they're always in different places, and they always serve what they do. They do a lot of kids shows as well. They do a Charlotte's Web, and they do the Headless Horseman thing every fall. So it's really cool, and they're really kind of pushing the mold as to what you expect.
So the Great Comet coming up is a little bit going to be site-specific, but, you know, they're going to immersive a little bit, and also the upcoming Ragtime on Ellis Island is going to be somewhat site-specific.
Oh, yes.
But the Great Comet, Dave Malloy, who wrote it, he had that 99-cent Miss Saigon that he did back, oh my goodness, I want to say 10 years ago or so, where they did a small little chamber production of Miss Saigon with a piano, and they flew a little tiny remote control helicopter in the scene and things like that. It's very, very funny, and it's really good. And so, wow, it's been 2013. It's been, you know, a while since we had Dave on. I didn't realize this was so far ago, but, you know, we have Natasha Pierre and The Great Comet of 1812 coming up on Broadway, renamed The Great Comet of 1812. So we'll have to take a look at that.
Not renamed.
They're just calling it The Great Comet, though. I don't think
logo still says Natasha Pierre, and then it says Natasha Pierre, and then The Great Comet of 1812. So it's still the name. It's just like they're repackaging it for Broadway to make it a little easier for people.
Seems
but I think
like
the title is officially still the same.
Yes, well, it seems like that there's really a lot of confusion there. I guess with the first big announcement of the Broadway production, I got a press release, and it just said The Great Comet, and it didn't say anything else, and it said The Great Comet about six times, and never once mentioned Natasha Pierre and The Great Comet. So I emailed the press agent, and I said, am I to assume that the title of the show has been changed? And they said, no, that's just what we call it.
The equivalent of Shuffle Along.
I mean, I have to say, to put out a press release that never once mentions the official title struck me as extremely odd. I think they're trying to figure out the most marketable thing, but in a way it's making it more confusing, and it's working against it. And plus, we're hearing all, who knows what's true, but we're hearing all different things about maybe problems in raising sufficient funds, because aside from the normal funds that are necessary to produce the show, they're reconfiguring the theater, which obviously costs a lot of money. So I certainly hope it happens, because it's one of my favorite shows of the past few years. But I hope they solve all of that and get it on.
All right, Matt, why don't you tell us about When Shadows Fall?
Well, that was another thing that I was interested in kind of bringing into that immersive thing, and it kind of ties in with what Michael had mentioned about Sleep No More. And there's a show here in Orlando that we didn't mention, but we can talk about it. It's another one of those kind of it's very much an immersive show that you are a part of, where you interact with the actors, and they call it kind of like a real life video game. This is an extension of something that was done last year here in Orlando called The Republic, which that was kind of their proof of concept, and now that went fairly well, they've invested a lot of money in this, and so it's a new immersive thing that they do down here. But the connection with Sleep No More is very obvious. The woman who created When Shadows Fall, The Republic down here had kind of been had worked on the original set of Sleep No More, and so it's very much this big intricate world of mythology and stuff, where apparently the actions of the group can change the ending of the show. So it's very much in the lines of what Michael talked about, not only Sleep No More, but that other kind of weird tropical destination show.
The Grand Paradise,
which I think I was actually on the episode when you talked about that. But it's just another way that people are getting creative and thinking outside the box of what we normally consider, you know, theater. Down here, we still get a lot of, you know, O'Neill, we still get a lot of Miller, we've got a great Shakespeare theater here, but we don't always get, we've only got maybe one theater here in Orlando that does, you know, more recent shows, more recent plays. So to see some people maybe, you know, pushing things outside of what we're used to seeing, I really appreciate and I really enjoy. And I might not always love the final product, but I always love the effort.
And some of them sound like so creative. There's one, I'm not going to be remember the details, but there was a show, I believe, that was actually done like in a car or a vehicle or a cab. And so the audience was limited to, I guess, two or three people at a moment, you know, at a time. And, you know, there were, the possibilities, I guess, are endless. And, you know, it doesn't, of course, mean that any one of them is going to be good or great or any one of them could be. But the creativity of just of the concept is can be really astounding sometimes.
And didn't they do in Times Square a few years back, like, was it Shakespeare for one? Didn't they do Hamlet for like one person at a time or something?
Yeah, they did a booth. Yeah, they did a
one-to-one booth.
Yeah, that is true. All right, so we're going to clean something up for about last week. Michael, in our discussion about Broadway originals last week, we failed to mention one person. Who was that, Michael?
I failed to mention the headliner, Tony Danza, and I wanted to correct it because I certainly didn't want anyone to think that I didn't mention him because he wasn't good. On the contrary, he was just great. I don't know. I had my notes, but I skipped over him when I was talking on the podcast. He ended the show with Out of the Sun from Honeymoon in Vegas, which is that song that Tommy Corman sings about how his former his wife died because she was such a sun worshiper that she died of exposure, basically, and I guess skin cancer. And on the face of it, it shouldn't be remotely funny, a song about that subject. But somehow, the way it's set up and the way he does it, I think it is. I know some people disagreed when the show is playing, but Tony Danza developed such great comic timing over the years on sitcoms, and I'm sure he had native talent there to begin with, but then he really honed it and developed it, timing and communication with an audience. And so he really is a wonderful performer. And then on top of that, as I mentioned before, when I first heard him sing some years ago, it was in a show at the old Feinstein's where I saw him, I remember thinking, well, he's tremendously charming and energetic, and he's great in every way except that the voice itself is not that good. But I have to say, he must have worked like a demon, because now his voice is lovely. It's supported. He has just enough vibrato to make it sound good. And not make it sound unnatural. He always sings completely on pitch. The tone is supported. He has a lovely crooning tone, and it's gotten so good that I think he actually could make an album if he wanted to. So I think that he deserves a lot of credit for that. Someone at that point in his career, after all his success and also at his age, to really work on a new talent and develop it like that. And so bravo to him. And he really, he was in the cleanup spot at Broadway Originals. He was the last performer and the audience just loved him. And so I'm sorry that I somehow forgot to mention it, but he really was just fantastic.
All right. That's great. All right, so let's wrap up for today. Before we get on to the answer for trivia, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. This is a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us on iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone or your Android device. Get a stream directly to you. Of course, Broadway World also plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m., and contact information for Michael, for Matt, and for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we talked about today. All right, so Michael, you had a trivia question last week. Do you want to give us the answer?
Yes, the question was, there was a 70s Broadway musical in which the leading lady at one point sang the title of another show that she would appear in some years later, and also sang the name of another performer who is known as an actress in Broadway musicals and plays. Who is that person and what are the shows? Phil Bond came up with an answer that almost sort of worked. He thought it was Liza Minnelli, who was in Chicago as a replacement for Gwen Verdon. I actually saw her in the show. And in Chicago, she does sing, Roxy sings about her act. So he was thinking that I was thinking that Liza was singing the act, but I don't know if she actually says the words the act or sings the words the act. So I'm not sure if that fits. But he did say that she also, in that same song, Roxy mentions Sophie Tucker. So that the second part really did fit. So that, I would say, is almost an acceptable answer, although I don't know if the words the act are actually sung by Roxy, even though she talks about how she, you know, she's going to have her boys and blah 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 and all that. But no, the person I was thinking of was Patti LuPone. And indeed, Robert Lobiondo got it, because in Evita, in the song Rainbow High, at one point, Patti as Ava sings, I'm their savior, that's what they call me, so Lauren, but call me Anything Goes. So Anything Goes was the show in which she would appear later, and Lauren Bacall, of course, was the actress who appeared on Broadway in several musicals and plays.
All right. So through the miracle of technology, we have Peter joining us. Peter, what's the trivia for this week?
If a Broadway musical has a title tune, be it Hello Dolly, Phantom of the Opera, Rent, Mamma Mia, it's expected to be heard in the show's film version. But there's at least one instance where a movie played the entire melody of the title song, three times in a row, in fact, in a 4.5-minute sequence without a single lyric sung. What's the title song, the name of the Broadway musical, and its film version?
All right. So if you know that, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com, and we'll let you know if you're on the right track. Okay. So on behalf of Matt Tamanini and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
You're not like a race.